Yes, it's 8:34 a.m. now. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning After Show, and we have another segment by Zeke for you.
Actually, you're not. I don't think you're going to hear my voice at all in this.
You're not.
No,
but it is by you.
No, Cindy Paremba and Heather Kelly, the part of the Cocoromi Collective.
I'm completely mistaken then. Okay.
Okay, yes, I did the slicing and dicing.
There you go. I knew you were involved somehow. So what is it all about?
Basically, Cocoromi is this game collective in terms of they do independent art games in terms of like video games, which I've been finding incredibly interesting for, I don't know, about the past 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. And back in May and June, when the Montreal Biennial was happening, they had a live game coding session, which was basically making a game while you watched or while you interacted. And I was completely and utterly sort of fascinated with it. So I went there.
Yeah, sounds cool.
Brought a recorder in and then, basically spoke to them. Then we went, after they closed down, we went across the street, had a couple of drinks, and the conversation mm-hmm. grew and grew and grew. But it's, the whole idea, as opposed to sort of like World of Warcraft and other sort of major games, which are very, very similar to major American films, there's this whole subculture of art games, indie games that is, doing some very, very interesting and very bizarre and very strange and very weird stuff, non-standard, that you would think about for gaming culture.
Mm-hmm.
And Cindy and Heather do their best to try and explain it.
Very cool. Let's listen in.
Okay.
About a game.
You just think about what you've done.
No, it's abstract because I was playing more with physics than anything else, and I was just using what was in our favorite game prototype that they provide when you get this engine, which is Rollaball, but we call it Rollyball. And I just took Rollyball, the original Rollyball, and modified it so that it just has a little bit different gameplay. Because my game's called Les Funambules, Tightrope Walkers, and it's supposed to be about balance in a relationship and how both people have to like be balanced and then sort of come together in the middle. And so this is like representing the tightrope, but what I have is just these two objects right now that are both physics objects. One is it's a ball, but sometimes it just acts like a cube and it doesn't roll, and then a bar, which is just like a column on its side, and it can roll like a bar would. And then the tightrope, quote unquote, is this curved surface in the middle, so you don't like immediately roll off the side, but you can sort of stay on it if you work hard
but
enough.
It's possible to fall off.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. In fact, that's pretty much like the entire experience is falling off of this thing right now because it's just my prototype. So if you're playing it, you can like you see the bar. You can see it there too, and on the screen too. But like the bar can, if you tilt it, the bar can roll down. And I also have a little impulse thing where you can. My ultimate idea is that you could just step along the like you wouldn't be able to roll along the thing. You'd only be able to step along it, and then just stay balanced in the other axis. So I can sort of. It's not really working because that bar is already about to fall off, but. I'm going to have to restart that one. If I hit that bar button, it gives it a little push. Oh, but sometimes it pushes it in the other way because it's like using... I realized later that it's probably using the axis that it's pushing it along is not the world axis, but the object's axis. So sometimes the axis that it's pushing along is facing that way, and so it jumps back and forth. Yeah, it'll just, whichever direction that axis is facing it at the time, it'll push it in that direction.
So you push it now, it'll go slightly back up?
Maybe. You don't know, because you can't see in the prototype which, you know, where the X, Y, and Z are. See, I'm American. X, Y, and Z. But you can also tilt it and make it roll down that surface, except right now it's like so tilted that it's kind of like sitting on the side and it won't come back. Push it a little bit. Ooh, there, it's rocking back and forth. But if you can't really tell, but the ball is also sort of moving, shifting. That's because it's also got physics. It's just not as, it's not rolling. It's, see, yeah, that's because I pushed the step button, which in the final game would be like you're stepping along the tightrope. Like you could
but
only
it can't fall off the ball.
Yeah, it could actually. It's probably really close to falling off right now, but it thinks it's a cube, not it doesn't think it's a ball, so it's not behaving according to physics. Yeah. Oh look, I've never done this before. This is a game I've never played before. I've never gotten the ball past the bar like that. Like the fact that the bar is
wow.
I made up my own game.
Falling.
Ah, but at least I did get past. Oh, yes. So that's what could happen. You could try to come together in the middle and you could end up just passing each other and going to the other side. The slots have the full documentation of the number of form edits and that sort of thing. The slots are a sexy lab.
Right.
And I realized I could just export from my web browser, so I did a little export of my log file, all the sites I went to. So they can literally check how many times I went on Facebook, not just how many times I said it on Facebook.
We're just going to count your Twitters, though.
Although, I wasn't really tweeting at this. I did over, like, last night and stuff, just to tell people to come, I think.
Yes, you're too successful with that.
What?
It was I think my most unproductive time was this morning when everybody showed up and, well, the little boy who came over and was playtesting my game, that was fantastic. I wish he could have stayed. He got bored with it pretty easy, but he wasn't. Yeah, yeah. To be honest, he was less bored than I thought he'd be for a long time. So considering it only really did one thing.
By the fact that you were making it and did something.
Well, yeah, I could change things on the fly as well. So I was going through and I was sitting and I was like changing the lights while he was playing around with the ball.
I borrowed the controls from other places where you can find scripts about it. Like this was the basic script that was already there for the original demo.
Well, how do controls?
So it has all this stuff about like it has physics and the physics engine built in, and these are the things that are just telling it how the physics behave.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to program any of this because it's already scripted, and I just used what was in this little demo, and then I added a few things of my own just for the buttons. That was what I was most proud of. All this stuff this already came with the demo that I used as my foundation. But I'm more proud of my step and my two things that give little physics impulses. Like I had to go look up how do you impulse something and figure that out.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and then also it involved creating a button which Cindy basically just gave me.
I basically just took that from the manuals.
Yeah.
The manual was actually really hard to find. I had it on my system. It's installed with Unity iPhone, but for some reason it's kind of a hybrid manual, which is half the original Unity and half Unity iPhone. And it has a lot of web links in it that goes to the manual, but the Unity manual. And a lot of the things I was looking up just don't work the same. Like a lot of the sprite handling and how you control things. I mean, I'm using things like the accelerometer and things that aren't in the original version of Unity. So the original manual doesn't do me anything. So for a long time, I had a hard time finding the right kind of stuff because I didn't really realize it was in the wrong part. But eventually, I managed to find it. I think that's when we started tracking our web our web searches and our. But I forgot what my big breakthrough was from yesterday. I had some sort of big.
Oh, you did.
Something.
Yeah. You were like up and dancing.
What was it? Dancing.
What was it? Dancing.
I don't even know what I did.
Yes.
What did I do? No.
I did because I saw it, but I can never see what's on your screen.
The happy mistake was
yesterday. Yeah, there weren't so many happy mistakes today.
Did you document that?
Oh, yeah.
We documented one happy mistake yesterday. I didn't see that happen. I was out of the room when that happened. I was totally right. I was moments away from breaking in the dance floor, and I wandered away, and I came back, and everybody was dancing by the time I got back. It was fabulous. Yeah, you were one of the dancers. Oh, Glenn and I were, we had a two-person dance.
I was the catalyst or the helper or something.
This is all communal stuff. The chocolate. Can we eat the swear jelly beans now that we're out of regular jelly beans?
I think so. We're going to dig into the swears.
This is not that bad. I usually fill a jar like this myself because I'm restrained. There are children in the room.
Do we have to repeat the swear when we eat the jelly beans?
Those are all my jelly beans.
Damn it.
And Phil. Phil's like half of them.
Yeah, Phil is like half of them. But he was intentionally. He was seeding the swear jar.
Can you give me background on the swear jar? Special.
Oh, it was just it was part of the whole visualizations thing, right? So we tried to do, originally we were going to do, we didn't actually end up doing any computational visualizations on our
path. Well, the lines of code, but that's it.
Yeah, sort of the, but we didn't, they're not really visualized. I mean, they're just, they're just the numbers. But, so we ended up doing, when we realized that was going to be a lot of work, we ended up doing a whole bunch of sort of just fun manual ones based on whatever we could think of. So those are my baby heads. So those were our moods. Is this your mood? Are you halfway in between cranky baby and mellow baby?
I think it was, I don't know, I can go happy now. I'm bad happy. I'm fully happy.
Yay!
Yay! Well, I'll do happy baby yoga.
So we had that going. We had, we checked email and Facebook procrastination, and also the our portraits per hour. We have a whole bunch of other.
It's just that, so then.
The jelly beans
are more along the documentation line.
Oh yeah, these are documentation.
It was our swear jar. That was when...
Do we need to have a picture of it? I mean, I'm already halfway dug through it, but...
Yeah, you can't... now that we ran out of jelly beans, the swear jar is in danger, but every time we swore, we had to put a jelly bean in the jar. And the idea was, eating the jelly beans in the jar, was that we give the jelly beans in the jar away. So that's a disincentive.
But... You can't really see them in there.
But then we ran out of jelly beans.
Put a little angle on it.
But it worked out pretty well, and it was a nice outlet because when the kids were here and I didn't want to swear, I just threw jelly beans. There was a whole handful of jelly beans that went in there at one point. I think it's when I had to rebuild all of my rigid body collision box things, whatever it is. Box gliders. box gliders are not my friend. That's what I learned. That's the big
no.
The big
box colliders are some of your best friends, but I guess actually sphere colliders are probably your biggest friends. Or point colliders. About the box. That would be the one.
There was, we're...
And then I'm happy that my microphone was not here to record about how rough her box needed to touch.
We had a whole...
We went in there.
There's like a full hour of
that might have been after we broke into the...
Rigid bodies and the other things that we were adding. But... Yep, we do it.
Mm-hmm. We're not afraid.
Somebody has to be brave enough.
All right, I guess we're going to start everyone off with the second part of your Kokoromi series.
Yes, no, this is, it's actually, I finished the editing. It's actually in total going to be 5 parts. Can you believe that those art game developers can speak so much? But yeah, basically Cindy Paremba and Heather Kelly are 2 parts of the 4-part collective called Kokoromi. They develop basically art games, indie games. It's not the sort of the, like World of Warcraft or Batman sort of stuff that you see out there, and they're trying to actually almost change the world through video games, which I think is a fascinating concept.
Mm-hmm.
And back when the Biennial, the Montreal Biennial was happening, they had taken over the one of the rooms at the Ecole Bourget, and we're doing a live game programming sort of session, which is sort of like taking game programming to performance art. And I'm not quite certain I bought into the concept. However, I was most definitely willing to listen to them.
Apparently, because you got 5 episodes worth of material out of that talk.
I wanted to chop it down into like my, because it is early in the morning, sort of like 10-minute, 12-minute sort of bits so that it is easily digestible, sort of like your cereal in the morning, sort of like porridge.
No. Zeke, what happened to the Burger Report?
Burger Report's coming up in the second hour.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, I was like, oh,
that's going nowhere. Don't worry.
And so, yes, as I think the phrase is, we have a jam-packed show this morning.
Wonderful. Yeah, and of course, at the half hour, we will have the big idea. Mm-hmm. Talking today about the work and legacy of John Mayne. And who that is, you'll find out in about 15 minutes. But first, here we'll start you off with part 2 of, I guess, the Kokoromi talks.
Yes, that would be a good name.
Thing we need to record for our final recording is the failures and successes. So I have to open my laptop and we can get them like side by side.
We started getting a lot better about documenting the successes.
We did.
And also we started becoming more successful.
There were a lot of failures early.
It was what was it, Heisenberg? Is that what it was? Yeah, it was a Heisenberg.
Is there when you look at it?
Yeah. There's more of it if you look at it.
Okay, well, how did it turn out? It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 fails.
Oh, are you opening back up?
Yeah.
Take a picture?
Yeah. So they can go together.
Which is this? This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
It's almost,
there we go, even feel.
Well, I don't know. I thought there was supposed to be a difference.
No, there isn't. We were just kind of grabbing them and flopping them on the fly. We didn't do a color coordinated thing on them.
We should have, in a way. But
I know that for a while I was trying to do, like, the reds were my personal fails, and these were just general fails.
Oh, yeah, we
fails.
Can unplug this.
But, between my personal and general fails. Well, my personal fails are like Unity crashing. I should have got more flags than that. That was a big fail. And
I never had a crash.
I think this first flag was we lost a package of flags.
Hey, can you both get your faces by your fails and wins?
Oh. Well, they're your fails and wins too.
Mine?
They're all of our failures and wins.
Damn it, I guess you're right.
Well, Steph dropped the flags.
Oh. Oh, down the, that was a whole package of them that went down the, in between?
Yeah, you might notice there's no green flags anymore.
You're right.
That's my elephant!
Oh, damn it, flag. No. No, we're done.
Elefail.
I can fail. No, elefail.
Did you accomplish what you said to accomplish?
I have something running and it's a toy. I have a toy. Oh, that's, you know, it doesn't have any built-in goals, so I can't officially call it a game. You have to have... Oh, that was my book. That's my inspiration book.
Apologies, I knocked it over.
Huh? They could. They can invent their own goals, and then they would have a game. But until it has its goals built in, then I can't say that I built a game. I built a toy that could be...
That could one day be.
Yes. So yes, I succeeded in learning a lot and having fun. Yes, I succeeded.
Yeah, I mean, I need to turn it into a game as a timer in the score.
Right. That's all you a ever
good game.
Need.
A good game, maybe something different. But. I mean, in terms of the concept of love letter, is that it's private and small. So in that sense, it doesn't really, it wouldn't really matter so much. It's an embedded critique of the commodification of the iPhone games. Because I can't actually give this to Derek, because he'd have to buy it, or he'd have to download it, he'd have to look through the App Store.
And plus he'd have to stop playing WoW.
He'd have to stop.
He doesn't play WoW. What's he playing? Call of Duty?
I'm coming. But I can't even just send it to him as a love letter. So
that Derek is the guy you're sweet on.
But it's my Derek's my partner.
The guy you're sweet on.
I'm pretty sweet on him. Mm-hmm. The game wasn't, you know, it's not violent shaking.
No.
It's just shake of love.
Love shake.
The love shake.
We've been together for a certain amount of time, and there's the shake of love, and then there's the hip check of love.
The love shake, and at which point then you go back to the B-52s.
Oh yeah.
Take out one.
If you see a faded sign at the side of the road that says 15 miles to the
I'm ashamed that I don't.
Love Shack.
Oh, it's Love Shack.
Love Shack.
That's the title.
Love Shack.
Yep.
Perfect.
Love Shack.
And you just have to be 52's play throughout.
Well, originally I was into the vocals. All the music and all of the sound effects vocally to kind of make it a little bit more personally, so I would totally hum it or sing it. And then I wouldn't have to worry about the copyrights on it. Trust me, nobody's gonna recognize it when I sing it.
But if it's for free,
it's theirs, and if they don't watch it for free, they can sing.
I could be ruining their reputation. And if I am singing, I'm definitely ruining their reputation.
That's why I turned on the mic for myself.
I know, there you go, you got the moment on there. I'm going to have to get that. When it goes big, when Love Shake goes global, I'm going to have that bit.
Great. See? It's viral.
Yeah, it's viral.
Oh, yeah. I was like, oh my god.
Oh, I'm going to hear it. Song.
Nice meeting you.
You too, sir.
What?
Come back. I can always come back. But you can also tell me if you forget something, and you can describe it. You know.
True.
Wine and cheese. It's our wine and cheese post-event soiree.
That's right. We're having our post-dissage.
Can Heather give the interview wearing a mustache?
I am wearing a mustache right now.
Oh, we need a picture with the mustache.
Mm.
Very classy.
Chiptunes are awesome.
Yeah. Oh, well, the chiptune show is your baby.
Yeah, it was my baby. We have like mid-season. I don't know. Like Coco Rami doesn't have any kind of standard behavior. Like we have Gamma that's every fall, or has been in the past every fall, and then like in between that we just do whatever we want. And we've been having. The first year we had the movie debut that in fact was when Cindy started working with us before she was even in Coco Rami. And then we decided, I don't think we did anything the next year in between the two Gammas because we were all working. But I wanted to have like a chiptune show and start to ideally like eventually want to be able to like bring up people from New York. There's a lot of people doing that there.
Yeah, we've been talking about that for a while.
Yeah, we've been talking about it for a while, and this one was a little more short notice, but because we had this opportunity to work with the Biennale, it seemed like a really great chance to sort of educate the world, because it's open culture, so it's really about the chiptune cultures are really quite an open culture. But it was interesting because we were the sort of go-betweens between this, like the people that were playing the show, Noya and Taxi Nouveau, were really excited to be playing at the art gallery, and the art gallery was really excited to have something as as happening as this chiptune show. And so it was like bringing those two worlds together. Mm-hmm. Like obviously they were both motivated to do this, but
and then it also goes through this convoluted path, which is Coco Rami organizing it in connection with the Techniculture Art and Games Group,
right.
Which is something
the Tag
that
Lab, which is who we are.
Lynn Hughes and Bart Simon put in as sort of the official project in the Biennale. And so the Coco Rami stuff is really in partnership with them. It's like a four-stage process, then.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of different organizations that are collaborating in this very open culture way. Like they're like, it basically is like Coco Rami saying we want to do this, and them saying okay, and just making stuff happen. So I think that's very much in the spirit of what the theme was for the Biennale this year.
The difference between games and other things like music, and music is actually one of my favorite things to compare to games, because I think games are more like music, and even in the independent game stuff that we do has more in common with independent music than, for example, something like film, which is for a lot of people their first cultural touch point when it comes to games. It's not a very good one, I don't think. But with music, you have other scenes, and you have other areas of exploration and stuff, so you can kind of find your right area. With games, that is just starting to really happen. I mean, it's been slowly happening for a good decade, but it's really started to become this big snowball with people who are really putting together truly innovative games, really creative games, and establishing themselves in something which I think is going to be somewhat similar to an independent music scene. So there are people who are fans of, like for example, I would say that I'm a hardcore gamer of independent and art games. I almost never play a commercial game. So when somebody asks me if I'm a gamer, it becomes hard to kind of explain where that distinction comes in, because most of the games I play, most people have never heard of. But on the other hand, most of the bands I listen to, most people have never heard of.
Yeah, the equivalent would be if all the music that was out there was, I don't know, either Britney or like death metal, and then maybe you could legitimately say
death
most
metal
people. Yeah, that's dangerous. I should be really quiet. But genre-wise, if everything that was promoted and was popular, or that got promotion and distribution, was of a certain genre, that's a little bit difficult to swallow for people that are not, completely. I don't know how to qualify it, but.
another part of the multi-part segment.
It's only five parts.
Five parts. The Kokoromi segment. And if people still don't know what it's all about, if you would care to enlighten everyone.
The Kokoromi sessions, maybe you'd like. It's basically an interview that I did with Cindy Paremba and Heather Kelly, who are members of this art/indie gaming collective. Mm-hmm. And it's discussions of sort of non-stream video games and how they get made. This all happened back in May and June during the Biennale de Montréal. And I think it's way easier to listen to is a sort of the Kokoromi sessions in five parts as opposed to one massive 3-hour thing where your head just ends up exploding.
I would think so. Uh-huh. Yeah. And this now is part three.
I think so, yes.
Yeah.
For instance, there was a girl who was at the lab at the very end. I'm talking girl, like 10 years old or something. And her mom, like, couldn't get her off the couch. She was playing Flower, a totally, like, peaceful, happy, positive game.
A countdown was given.
Yes. Multiple times countdowns were given.
We are leaving in 5, yes. 4,
but
3.
But she'd never played a game before because, what, her dad or some other one of her parents?
Yeah, her dad didn't want her to play games because he thought that games were too violent.
It's a philosophical discussion. There's so many different aspects to it. Even when I say intent, I was saying the answer is intent. Like, if your intention is to make money only and do that by meeting the needs of a customer and doing, like, design being the design process of making something to meet the needs and, in this case, the emotional needs of a certain audience, and that you subserve all of your personal expression to that intent, then that's not art, not, you know, whatever, indie. That's a commercial game. You're doing it to make a profit, and you're doing it to appeal to the people who would be most likely to buy a game, and appeal in whatever way necessary to sell the most copies. And an independent game may also want to sell a lot, and it could sell a lot, but if your intention is more to realize a personal vision, then I just said, you could certainly make lots of money. It's just that a commercial game is only to make money. It's not.
Yeah, and I really don't think it's something you can do by accident. I mean, we keep talking about expressive potential and exploring expressive possibilities within games. And independent games tend to do that really well because they are actively exploring that sort of area. That's sort of the primary motivation behind making a lot of these games. And that's really what makes them good. Blockbuster titles really explore expressive potential within games. If one did, then I would
certainly... There's nothing stopping it from doing so, right?
I mean, then I think that we would recognize it more as being in the spirit of independent games or something along those lines. This is sort of my whole kind of last 2 years, last 5 years point, because a lot of it has to do with, this is going to sound really lame, but audience development. So, audience development. So, for example, I can see people now, and even like students that I had from ages back who are just starting to graduate now, who want to be indie game designers and developers. They don't want to work for Ubisoft. They don't want to work for EA. They want to start their own companies. Mostly because people can actually see viable independent companies now, where you literally did not have that 2 to 5 years ago. If you wanted to have a job in game design and game development, you wanted people to buy your stuff and play your stuff and realize that you get media reports and critics to actually play your stuff, then you have to be part of a company. All of these people who were part of Ubisoft, so they were part of EA's, all the rest of that. And so now that you actually have that as a viable option, you get people, first of all, who are leaving those groups. I mean, Heather, I don't know if I can actually, I don't know if I can say where you've left, but, or where Phil has left, or why. Any of these other companies that people have essentially, there's been a bit of an exodus of creative, like truly creative talent from a lot of those companies, because it's a viable option now for people to start their own companies, because there's an audience now who buys those works and who follows those works and who will support them financially. And so now you actually have, it'll be really interesting to watch even within the next 5 years, because now you have people who are going through game design programs and who want to be game designers, but they don't want to work for Ubisoft anymore. They want to have their own company.
It's true.
They want to be the next indie game. They want to be the next John Blow. That's something that people can actually look to now, and they don't have to, that's not the...
They romanticize it, of course. I mean, it's really hard work. But it depends on the sort of type of your vision, because if you want to be like Clint Hawking, and he's making like super big time games with hundreds of people, like the kind of games that he makes are also considered art, but if you want to make a game of that scale, you have to be in a big company. You can't just take off on your own your first year and make Splinter Cell or Far Cry. You have to be in these big machines, like closer to home. But then you do have a more vision that relies on its artistry or its innovation in other areas. It doesn't rely on super high-end technology, lots of asset production, then you're much freer to do that.
It's still a song. But then you also get things like, I mean, we've been working over the past 2 days with Unity. And, you know, I think Torque's also come out with a new version, and they have an indie license, and Unity's just come out with a brand new... We discovered when we were trying to get onto the iPhone forums the other day that Unity just came out with a new iPhone development system. And those types of tools have become so much easier. I mean, even for me, comparing Unity to Torque, which I can't wrap my head around, it's not a programmer. Unity and those easier types of tools, I mean, they're almost the, they're like the Final Cut or the Adobe Premiere of game making. They're not easy. You know, they're not like kind of dumbed down, easy, play with this template types of tools. They're really rich, and if you want to get into the programming, you can go in there and you can use, you know, you can program in C#, you can program in Boo, which is this Python offshoot. You can actually get down into doing really complicated things, but you can also, it also has a really easy to understand interface. It knows what you want, what you're going to want to do in terms of workflow, and I mean, the whole thing with Heather and I doing this games thing over the past couple of days is that, I mean, we didn't end up with full-fledged games in the 12 hours we were working, but we got pretty far. For people who don't have a background in computer science and don't have a
physics,
yeah, who don't have a background in programming, you can do some significant things with these tools, and that too then allows people to go in. I mean, hopefully people see us working on projects like that and at least have an idea of what, like, it's not that we want to do something like that to say that it's easy to make games or it's hard to make games, but I think the really big issue is that people don't even know what they need to know, and that's the scariest thing. They don't know how, you know, if now knowing that it's going to be a little bit difficult but not completely impossible is actually invaluable knowledge. Because then you can go through and you can say, all right, well, it's going to take this amount of time. I'm going to need these skills. I'm going to need to do these sorts of things. And just knowing that allows you to go in informed anyway. So I think you get a lot of experimentation, and you get a lot of new designers and different types of designers. I mean, I'm not saying that people can't design from a whole bunch of different perspectives, but you know, you also get games that are, you look at really innovative games like Flower, put together by Kelly Santiago and Genova Chen, and or games like once you just get different, or Tales, Gloria Harvey and we'll be right back.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, and it's now 7:18 a.m. And yeah, we'll be right back. Good morning. This is the Wednesday Morning After Show. It's now 7:09 a.m. And of course, this station is CKUT 90.3 FM, if you had any doubts. We have a very good show for you today, and we're going to start you off with the kind of thing that we've started you off with for the past, I guess, 3 shows and 3 weeks, namely part 4 of Zeke's Kokoromi conversations, or Kokoromi sessions, or talks. I don't know how to call it yet, but they're talks about video games, if you haven't been listening in. And for those of you who have, this is simply part 4 of this ongoing conversation, and I believe there are 5 parts, and after that we're going to have to figure out something else to play you first thing in the morning, but you can be certain that we will.
Yeah, well, I think there's kind of 2 sides to it too, and I hope people picked up on the community aspect of it. We were tracking things like number of times we hit forums. We had some people come in who were, who we'd ask advice on various aspects of, we're trying to, just even having people as a sounding board just to say, this is what I'm trying to do. This is what I think I'm doing. Am I on the right track? Am I not on the right track? I actually have a lot of patience working something through if I know I'm on the right track. So that those kind of community aspects and that support community that's there for building games, so people get an idea that that's what's going on. But I also think one of the coolest things that happened from my project was when I had the little boy come over, and he was I had him kind of play testing a really, really early version of my game what I was doing. And the great thing about the tool that I was using is that you can prototype, and then you can also change variables and things on the fly. So, I could do things like...
Settings.
I could increase more drag, or I could increase velocity, or I could try to do things. So he'd be doing, he'd be tilting, he'd be shaking. Yeah, he'd be shaking the iPod. Well, he kept tilting. He kept tilting my character, my one character. I hadn't had a bounding box on the end yet, so my other character was me. So I'd go careening off the side of my game, and then he'd try to tilt it back, so I would come back. And so then on the fly, I'm trying to change the variable so that, okay, well, what if I give myself more drag? I wouldn't go flying off the side like that. And even just somebody seeing something like that, I mean, that kid now has a sense that when he's playing a game, that, first of all, that all of these things are things that somebody's actually thought about.
When
and
people
had to,
ask, like, you're a game designer, so you make the art, so you're a programmer, and you're like, no, but it's so hard to, like, quantify.
Yeah, I was trying to explain to people, because I talk to a lot of, because I've worked with documentary games, I talk to a lot of documentary filmmakers, and a lot of them aren't gamers. It's very, the overlap, the Venn diagram of the situation is actually very, it just doesn't quite work out.
Even gamers sometimes, like especially young ones, don't quite get
true. Don't understand what you have to do.
Design. Like they just think it happens. Yeah. It happens because it happens.
And
like,
one thing
every
I was trying
detail
to,
needs to be designed.
I was trying to sell them on playtesting, and fortunately, I was actually speaking with somebody else who was a game producer, and who was very knowledgeable in kind of the production techniques, and. And I don't remember what the scenario was, but I remember answering back that you need to play test it, and then we had people in the audience who were coming back and going, oh, well, what you mean like all the way through, and oh no, and I think I realized after that was the assumption that they were coming in through, that it was sort of getting that kind of that audience feedback stage, or that pre-screening or whatever, where you've got to go back and tweak things.
Market testing.
Rather than something which was actually part of the production process itself, and which allowed you to, which was really the only way that you can see all of the ways this complex scenario unfolds with player actions, which is absolutely impossible to predict beforehand. And I mean, you can kind of theorize and you can suspect what people are going to do, but until you actually see people do it,
People in other media don't understand it quite as well because they can take for granted so much. Like, they can take for granted now that certain kinds of cuts in film will, to us, mean time has passed, for instance. If you go from a day night scene to a day scene, it's not like suddenly, magically, that the time has changed. No, it's that, like, 12 hours have passed. So they can take that for granted. But in game design, every little thing like that is innovative. Like, we cannot assume that people... I mean, the equivalent. It's obviously not literally that. Blow up modems. Like, try to test them until they
break them
up. Break things, yeah. Well, that's quality testing. That's different. That's not playtesting.
Okay. Yeah, that's all almost right. That's all almost right. More what I did when doing interface design. It's more user testing. So I was, I used to develop all of these different case scenarios where, okay, well, I am this person going through doing this. I'm interested in this, and then I used to go through and break all my stuff.
Right.
It's basically easy to break digital interactive media stuff. You just come in with all of these assumptions because you built it. You know how you want it to work. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I think that interactive media. What's interesting about interactive, like any type of interactive media, is that in a lot of cases, I think that with film and some music and things like that, you take for granted what people are going to think from it. I mean, if you could put a film out there and nobody can get it, not a single person outside of yourself could understand what you meant to convey with a film, and you would never know that. And it's not really something that you would worry. What if that
eraser head?
Yes.
Or you could just not like it. I think that's a different issue.
Yeah, no, it's a completely different issue. But with interactive works, because somebody actually has to understand. A lot of times, somebody has to understand it in certain ways.
You can't even
Bring it through. It becomes a lot more apparent what people understand and what people don't understand. It's made visible in a really
very concrete way
that doesn't happen in a lot of other forms of media.
Because you can still sit there in the chair and look forward, no matter whether you understand that the fact that it's now in slow-mo means that it's an emotional moment. Well, there's two phases. There was actually, back in the Scott Burnham days, Kokoromi spoke at the Pechacucha the same night that he did, and we approached him back at that point about possibly doing some kind of game in the streets sort of thing. That didn't go anywhere, and then the next thing that happened was the Tag Lab at Concordia got asked by the Biennale more recently to participate, and then there's a sort of informal but close connection between the people of Kokoromi and the people of Tag, and the fact that, well, for one, Cindy's in both, and for two, I collaborate with Lynn on other projects at Concordia. So there's a lot of overlap there and a lot of mutual respect and adoration. And I can't even quite remember how it happened, but once Tag Lab was asked to participate, I think Lynn probably asked us just in general what we'd be interested in doing, and the wheels started spinning. And so that's when... Oh, also, I've been working on this live game coding concept above and beyond, outside of the Biennale, for some things in the future for me, specifically learning how to be more independent in making games and coding and stuff. Both, I would say. Because, I mean, yeah, duh.
Yeah,
yeah. Because, well, for me, part of my motivation in doing it and proposing it is because I've been trying for maybe 2 years now to find a way and a time to teach myself how to be a little more independent, because I've been always working on large projects, and I've been doing design, but not really in control of all the pieces to make things come together. So I've been relying on other people, and I love to collaborate, and it hasn't been a problem, but sometimes there's things you just want to do yourself, you know? And it is a little complex, and so learning to do that, like learning to code, maybe it takes a lot of investment of time and effort, and I basically need to trick myself into doing it. So by doing it in front of other people and making myself answerable to that, that's how I force myself to do things instead of putting it off because it's hard and it's a huge hill to climb and I'm at the bottom when other things are fulfilling but come a lot easier but don't get me where I need to go. So for me, the idea of Live Game Code was part of my long-range project to get myself to do this. All the stuff we're doing with tracking what we're doing was kind of my my thoughts of how to, well, for one, I'm really interested in data visualization as a design field, and it's really an interesting field where a lot of people are doing fun stuff right now. It's fun. It's like it's fun to see behind the scenes and see, like, oh, I don't know, just the things we're tracking and then find fun ways to sort of show that. I have a lot of friends who work in that area. And the other thing was, I knew that if I was doing this live game coding thing and it was just me sitting at a computer with what I was doing up on a screen, that'd be horrendously boring and not very participatory and not very elucidating. And doing the visualizations is a way to bridge the activity with the audience. And my original thought was that the visualizations would be coded, and so it would be taking what we were doing and automatically turning it into a visualization, which could in fact be a later phase of the project. But when Cindy kind of like thought of all these different ways to do the physical, she has a really great list.
I'm old school.
Yeah, the old school ways. And I was like, you know, this is brilliant because the lab is the perfect environment for having that, and it's fun. And it was just eye-opening. Like, this will let us do it, and it'll be really visually engaging and tactile, and it's just so much better than thinking I'm going to go into processing and figure out how to make all my data, like, output to a file that's going to make a...
an interaction design moment. So I wanted to change those baby heads.
You wanted to... yes, you were motivated to change the baby heads, and that was...
the three-sided, three-mood...
Yeah, yeah.
Doll heads.
I'm very ambitious, so I certainly would love to have had something that was, like, truly a game. But by the same token, I'm realistic. I've been doing things like this long enough that I know not to get, like, terribly emotionally invested in, like, this image in my head that I have of what it should be. And it was what I thought it should be in the sense that it was a great time. Like, there was people there all the time. We were one of the busiest rooms at... okay, the busiest. I actually haven't had time to go see the other exhibits. And that the visualizations were like genius, and the lab coats were like hilarious. Those are my standards. It's like, am I having fun? Are other people here having fun and learning something? And I learned a lot. Like, I did learn things. So yeah, it was worth it to me. The frustrations, the technical frustrations were high, but I've done it again. I've done this often enough that I know to expect that. And the fact that we got as far as we did, and I had a thing at the end where I had written or modified / written some lines of JavaScript that I don't even know how to use JavaScript, you know? And
as you have probably by now, if you're a regular listener, been used to with the Kokoromi Talks. This is part 5, where Zeke...
last one.
The last one where Zeke speaks about the wonderful new shiny world of what's off the beaten path in terms of video games.
Yeah, Cindy Paremba and Heather Kelly talking about alternate and art game development.
Very cool. But first, let's start with the Kokoromi Talks, part 5, the last.
I could ask Heather a question, she could ask me a question.
Well, you can go ahead and ask me a question, maybe I'll have one for you.
You're not going to counter question?
Maybe, I can't tell, I don't know what your question is.
I could see myself getting further in the game as I originally had envisioned, but I know that the reason why I didn't do it had more to do with just the experience of making it. I mean, I could have been a total antisocial geek and parked myself in a corner and not shared what I was working and not paid attention to what was going on and worked on it there. And I don't know. And that might not even have worked because a lot of the breakthroughs that I had because my first big breakthrough was going over and watching what Heather was doing. And
Yes, the rolly ball on site. The rolly ball was the heart of everything. This was, I think, the first big insight. So yeah, I don't think there wouldn't have been anything that I would have changed. I certainly couldn't have changed anything to... I wouldn't have had more fun if I had ended up with doing everything that I would have thought that I would have accomplished, because every accomplishment along the way was fun, and it was really satisfying. So I made mistakes where I learned, 10 times what I learned from the successes. So. My one favorite moment was definitely when I found out that I could get the shadows from my 2D men. And it was a purely aesthetic thing, and it just looked fantastically cool. And part of it had to do with the fact that I had no intention of doing that, and it was completely and utterly an accident that turned out really,
the shadows?
Really fantastic. I didn't end up using shadows in the end because I didn't bring in a background, but even knowing that that happens now, I can do something cool with in the future. That was pretty happy. The jokes about the colliders were pretty good too.
I don't like having an individual favorite moment is hard, but for me it's like sort of like halfway through when like most of the early rough spots of training people what's going on are a little through, so it's sort of flowing and going on its own. And like I'm sitting there in a room and I'm surrounded by my friends and I'm like coding a game and like we're happy and we're just playing around and eating jelly beans and making stuff and I'm just like, I'm so happy. Like it's...
The swear jar was a good idea.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's more of a gestalt for me than like a individual. Yeah. It was good for me. Was it good for you, Cindy?
It was good for me. I ended up with something that I was happy with. Getting in down to like the last hour, I was at a point where I'm just like, yeah, this is good. In the morning I was getting a little worried, but by the end of the day, I certainly had something which I could see. I mean, I generally just want to get to a point where I can be confident that I can finish what I wanted to originally do. And like last month I was at a hacking workshop too, and the same thing happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't end up with our final product, but all of the scripts were there and all of the mechanical pieces were there. And if we had an extra day to do it, it would have absolutely been done. There was no reason why it wouldn't have been.
Right, it's only time
sort of,
now.
Yeah, and that's sort of where I found that I came. And I think that's where you came too. I could see in the game that you ended up with what you wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully
that's
you
good.
Could see that in my, at least I could see in mine that the only things that were left in mine were grunt work in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Finding ways to track things, putting in extra animations and that sort of thing. So I was extremely happy with that.
Yeah.
That and, I mean, again, just on your point, it was just so much fun.
Yeah.
It was a tremendous amount of fun.
Yeah.
If people came in and saw how much fun we were having and go and decide to spend a weekend making games to have a lot of fun, grab a bottle of wine and hang out with a bunch of girls and make games,
yeah.
Wow, how cool that would be. That'd be fantastic. Heather has a very clear next step.
I do.
Which you sort of alluded to earlier a little
bit. Yeah, I have a very clear next step, which I can't talk about very in much detail. But, well, then what's the point?
Just off the record?
But my very clear next step, I can't talk about the details, but I'm going to do more of this. Like, I want to... I still need to force myself to learn how to do stuff. Like, I'm incredibly lazy and incredibly distractible, and I actually am enjoying the pressure of having it be in public. And it's to maybe take what I started and progress on and make it into an actual game that I could have it as downloadable in the iTunes App Store. And that could continue on quite a while, because especially if you're working alone or with a few other people, it takes a while to make these things. And so I would like to do that and eventually be able to more rapidly develop and publish my own stuff. I need the pressure of somebody sort of paying attention, but I also would need time away from those people, and that would be the ideal. It was like largely amounts of time away, but then occasional sort of milestones or times when I needed to be in public and accountable to incite me to continue to progress.
So if we hadn't watched Star Trek last night?
If we hadn't watched Star Trek last night, I would probably have drinking more sangria, but I'd not been falling asleep at the table when I did. But I'd say, no, you don't have to. There's plenty of people who have made lots of games without being in front of an audience. But for me, like, having
there's ragdoll peggle.
There is ragdoll peggle. You'll end up with that if you're not careful. Or if you try really hard. Every programmer that I showed my proposal to about doing this were like, that's crazy. They basically thought it was like that. Not only did they say that it was crazy, okay, not all of them consistently, but some were like saying that's scary. Like, and to me, it's like, no, it's not. I mean, I'm putting the pressure on to actually do some work. It's not like I'm putting a specific goal as pressure. And I'm really social, so to me, this seems more fun than scary. But to some people, it's scary. Maybe because they feel pressure to do it right, because they basically know how to do it already. Whereas I know that I know nothing about how to do it. The whole thing is completely ridiculous, and therefore there's no fear.
I mean, that ends up being the one, I guess, downside in the kind of independent art game scene, is that if you're not part of a company, then you do have to find ways to have that accountability and to have that
motivation.
That mutual support when everybody's doing different things. It's not just getting things done because somebody's waiting on you, but it's also getting things done so you can show other people who are working on the
same. It was sort of like realizing that it was really hard and that shouldn't be so mysterious. Like, the fact that it's hard is obvious to me, but that's prevented me so far from doing it. But now it's like, well, shit, it's hard. Well, I'll just show people that it's hard, but you can still do it.
I actually think that's one thing Heather and I can do, because we're generally just performance-y people. It really doesn't bother me to do things in public. I don't get stage shy, I don't get performance shy. The concept of it bothers me in kind of a broader sense, but the actual speaking in front of people, performing in front of people, coding, producing things. That you're being recorded. I'm being recorded, and oh, I hope I don't say anything foolish, and oh, I hope I don't mean things in the out of context.
I don't like worried about that when it's scripted. Like, if I have to deliver something very scripted and precise, but if I'm just being myself, especially, I mean, this is like a room where there was like maximum, we had like 20 people, and sure, they're giving you a lot of attention, and it's very, very visible. You're kind of vulnerable. Like, I was out doing a TED talk or something like that, you know? You can turn it off.
And we're back. It's now 7:16 a.m. This is still the Wednesday morning after show.